In late December, the Arab League sent a team of monitors to Syria to document the violence that has resulted from the government's crackdown on protesters. But the mission quickly ran into trouble. Now, as the United Nations Security Council meets this week to decide how to address the situation in Syria, a series of confidential memos about the Arab League's mission reveal how it was ill-fated from the beginning. Colm Lynch, who reports on the United Nations for the Washington Post, obtained those memos and has written about them for the Turtle Bay blog for foreignpolicy.com. I'm very pleased to welcome him to today's second backstory segment. Hello.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Was the team of monitors the first time that the Arab League had done any human rights monitoring?
It was the first time they certainly had done any human rights monitoring of this type, you know, sort of deploying a group of peacekeepers in monitors in a crisis area, and they didn't have a lot of experience. They largely recruited government functionaries, some NGOs, but clearly, you know, these were people who didn't have a long experience with doing this sort of thing in the way that, you know, the United Nations does this sort of things all the time, and they have a pretty large, you know, sort of stable of people that know how to do this.
Well, the violence had been going on in Syria for months. What prompted the Arab League to act in late December?
Well, I mean, there has been, you know, gradual. This is the sort of thing that the Arab League generally doesn't do. I mean, what we're seeing over the last year or so is that the Arab League is doing things that it's never done before, supporting a no-fly military enforcement mechanism over Libya, at criticizing Arab governments for human rights abuses. So I think, you know, essentially this is a long, difficult process to sort of over time to build up political pressure, from the Europeans first, from the Americans, and finally, you know, the Arab League got on board, and there was great resistance to outsiders coming in the UN, so it was kind of natural that the Arab League still had, you know, kind of working relationship with the Syrians, that they were the ones to do it. But
well, you know, Syria is a member of the Arab League itself, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Go ahead.
Yeah, so I mean, which is, you know, sort of why you would see there's also a lot of interest within the international community more broadly to see a regional organization taking the lead. But I think, you know, the Arab League comes late to this because this is kind of a huge change for them to be sort of engaged in this kind of more intrusive kind of monitoring spectrum role for one of its members.
Well, although Syria is a member of the Arab League, you get the feeling Assad's government feels it has no obligation to respect it. Didn't the mission, which had 166 observers, run into problems from almost the very beginning when Syrian border guards confiscated a lot of their communications gear?
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of a disaster. They show up, they go across the border, they have some of their own communication gear. They take that away, so they get into the country. They don't have, they've got like 10 satellite phones, which they can't use inside buildings. So they're essentially required to use all of the local Syrian, kind of fax machines and phones, which are all bugged and, you know, present their own problems. They don't have enough walkie-talkies to communicate with one another. They're in 15 locations around the country, and they can't communicate. They had to go to the Chinese embassy to borrow like 10 walkie-talkies from them. So there were a lot of technical problems. They didn't have, bulletproof vests. They were going into areas where there was fighting.
They were being attacked by pro-government protesters in some cases.
They were being attacked in one case in one town in Latakia. They came under attack by a bunch of demonstrators chanting pro-government slogans. The government said, you know, they had nothing to do with it, apologized profusely. But, you know, life was quite difficult for them.
Well, the report that you obtained was written by the chief of the Arab League's mission, General Mohammed Ahmed Mustafa al-Dabi, who had been a close advisor to Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir and served as a top military officer in Darfur. That kind of discredits the report in the eyes of many outsiders, doesn't it?
Well, certainly in the West. I don't know exactly how that came about. I mean, I presume the Sudanese, you know, put him forward partly because he was close to Bashir, but also because he had also, in addition to being a military commander in Darfur, when the government was involved in, you know, efforts to recruit these sort of Janjaweed militia, was responsible for a lot of the atrocities in Darfur. He also participated as a representative Bashir in the peace talks in Doha in Qatar. So the Qataris are the ones, you know, who have the top position of the head of the chair. You know, they have the chair of the Commission of Ministers in the Arab League, and they're kind of overseeing a lot of the Arab League diplomacy on this. So the idea was, here is a guy who has good close relations with the Qataris, and so that probably played a role in, you know, their selection of this guy. But, you know, it's a huge public relations disaster when you have a guy who's kind of associated with, you know, an indicted war criminal, with, you know, massive atrocities in Darfur, that he's the guy who's coming in to save the day for the Arab League in Syria. So, so there was, you know, the sort of the optics were not good from the very beginning.
And at least one Algerian monitor resigned in protest of his selection. Does his report minimize some of what other sources, including journalists, have reported seeing?
There is criticism of the government. I mean, mentioning for one, the attack on the peacekeepers. There are other cases where they're quite critical of the opposition, saying that they also attacked and targeted civilians. In one case, a bus that had some civilians in it. But there's one particular case where there was the killing of a French journalist. And the report sort of categorically concludes that he was killed by opposition forces in an exchange. And that's all it says about it. There's not much context. There's not much detail. And the French foreign minister, who was in New York for a big Security Council meeting on this week, sort of objected to that characterization and said, you know, they didn't provide any context. And the context was that pro-government sort of protesters and demonstrators allegedly, you know, dragged this guy and put him out in front of fire between, you know, and didn't not so much use him as human shield, but put them in the line of fire of the opposition, and that played a role in his death. So so there was a sense that you know, by the sort of lack of context, that it essentially provided a biased account in that case.
Why have the findings of the fact-finding mission become a bone of contention between Russia and the European members of the Security Council?
Because the leadership of the Arab League is going in the direction of pushing Assad from power, and they're coming to the Security Council this week to ask the Security Council to support a proposal that they're promoting, which would lead to a political transition along the lines of Yemen. So talks between the opposition and the government, creation of a national unity government, Assad yielding power. Now, if you look at this report sort of says quite clearly that we shouldn't go down that route, that we shouldn't internationalize this crisis, that we should keep it in the Arabs' hands. And it presents a view, and it reflects, you know, the fact also that there's division among the Arabs, that the Sudanese, along with the Algerians, the Egyptians to a certain degree, the Iraqis, are not so keen on, you know, supporting and pursuing the course that the Arab League is pursuing, that they're much more cautious, they're much more sympathetic to the government. And so this report reflects that. So what you see, what was kind of amusing about the whole debate in the Security Council is you had the Arab League Secretary General, you had the Qatari Prime Minister selecting certain quotes from Dabi's report, which were saying that, you know, that there was all sorts of obstruction by the government. And then you had the Syrians and others pointing out other stuff, which was showing that the opposition was engaging in awful acts and being quite difficult. So it became this sort of political football. And the Russians, essentially, you know, have been acting as kind of the defender of Syria. And I think that they'd like to change the debate, and they would also don't want a Security Council resolution applying greater pressure on Syria. So they would use that report. They had initially asked for Dabi to come himself and brief the council, and the Arab League nixed that. But he wants to sort of change. They want to change the discussion. They want to change the whole frame of it. And so that's how they're kind of playing different pieces of this.
Well, the Russian government also opposed the UN's action in Libya. But Syria buys a lot of arms from Russia, in fact, some $4 billion worth. And Russia is unwilling to vote on an arms embargo. Do the other members of the Security Council have many ways of getting the Russians to back down?
Well, there's been a lot of developments today. There's this resolution that everybody's looking at, which would support the Arab League plan for a political transition. Essentially what the effort now is to get the Russians. They know they're not going to support, an embargo. They know they're not going to support sanctions, but they at least want them to get the Russians to support the Security Council to support this Arab League proposal.
This is the Moroccan proposal, right?
This is the Moroccan proposal, which is really kind of drafted by the Europeans, but then the Moroccans, came in with other Arab governments afterwards, and they're all sort of.
Where do the Chinese stand in all of this?
Way in the background. The Chinese in August vetoed a resolution on Syria, sanctions resolution, with the Russians, but this is largely viewed as Russia's kind of taking the lead. China is quite reluctant to go against a resolution if it has regional backing in the way that this does with the Arab League. So, they're kind of hiding, and they don't want to go up against the Arab League, but they like to sort of back up the Russians because the Russians back up them. So I'm not clear whether they would do a double veto with the Russians if they vetoed, but they're in a quite difficult position. I think that they'd rather the council didn't do anything, but they don't want to be in a conflict with the Arab League.
Meanwhile, the situation looks like a typical UN situation where all these conflicting forces lead to little actually being done. And I have to leave it there, unfortunately.
Okay.
Colm Lynch writes the Turtle Bay blog for foreign policy, and he reports on the UN for the Washington Post. Thank you so much for talking about what's happening at the UN on our backstory. On tomorrow's show, The New Yorker's John Seabrook explains how YouTube is maintaining its competitive edge. Then Tony and Emmy Award winner Cynthia Nixon on her role in the Broadway revival of Wit. Also, the BBC's A History of the World in 100 Objects takes a look at a form-fitting gold cape worn by a very powerful person in Bronze Age Britain. And then we will take the temperature on the unusually warm weather we've been having. Plus, our Please Explain series on how to save the world looks at efforts to combat climate change. The Leonard Lopez Show is produced by Blake Neshick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Keith Korn, Ellen Frankman, and Sarah Waltuck. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopez, your host. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you tomorrow.